assume that buyers have to come in to this thing with integrity. And when they say, I'm not planning to change anything, that has to be your plan. Because if you're planning to create a revolution within the business, tell them. Chances are they're going to retain some sort of ownership. There will be an earn-out or other type of agreement, which will cause a lot of tension if you're not forthcoming about your plan.
Who is your successor? Probably going to end up being your buyer. And the easy way to build that succession plan outside of your firm, if you don't have a potential partner inside your firm, is to just look and say, look, I think you do great things. You know, we're in similar practice areas. I'd love to develop something that if something happens to me or when I'm ready to retire, that I can go to you and say, here.
You're listening to the Grow Law Firm podcast, where each guest shares actionable, practical ideas with you on how to get more clients, expand your reach, and grow your law firm's revenue and profit. Here's your host, Sasha Burson.
Hi there. I have a small but really meaningful favor to ask you. You know, I watch At The Stats on our YouTube channel and Spotify channel, wherever people, most people listen and watch our podcast. And I see that over 80% of everybody who listens to it regularly is not a subscriber. I'm asking you to subscribe to this channel. And the reason for that is my mission and the mission of my team is to help as many small law firm owners to learn how to transform their law firms into better businesses, and so they in turn enjoy better lives. When you hit subscribe button, you tell these platforms that this is content worth listening, worth viewing, and they in turn will show it to many other small law firm owners and hopefully help me fulfill our mission of helping them create a better business and enjoy better lives. So would you please do me this favor? It would mean the world to me. And hit the subscribe button. And my promise to you is that I will continue to work hard at creating good content with practical ideas that help you and your teams grow better law firms. Thank you. Welcome to another episode of GLF, the podcast that is focused on growing law firms. I have an amazing guest here who has been on this podcast before, and I welcome back Tom Linfasti. Tom is the founder and CEO of Law Practice Exchange. As far as I know, it is the only marketplace for buying and selling law firms. And I'm very excited to have Tom back on the show.
Yeah, Sasha, thanks for having me back. Glad to have the opportunity to continue the conversation.
Absolutely. If you haven't heard our first episode, it aired on May 29th. Check it out on Spotify, YouTube, wherever you may be listening. Tom is an absolute wealth of information. And there's more than one way to grow a business. You can grow it organically, which for most law firms is about 4.3% per year, snail pace. For aggressive growing law firms, you could see 25 and more percent per year, but there is way to grow it much faster by buying a law firm, integrating with another law firm, or if you're inclined to not start a law firm, but hit the ground running by buying an existing law firm, you can also do that. And to people who know a little bit about this, this could be very alluring. You're basically buying cash flow at usually three times the cash flow. So if the law firm kicks off $250,000 in net profit pre-tax, you're paying like three times that amount and you're now an existing law firm owner. But the process is actually not that simple. So today, Tom is going to share with us the actual deal process, the deal killers, the missteps that people make, and what does a deal team look like on the seller side and the buyer side.
Absolutely. Excited to talk about, you know, really the nuts and bolts, right?
Yeah.
And as we talk about or talk to a lot of attorneys, Sasha, over the last, you know, several years of doing this, there's lots that are interested in potentially buying. There's lots that are interested in potentially selling. I think where, you know, so many get hung up is knowing what the process is, knowing how to really complete it, because again, it's not like you've bought a law firm or sold a law firm before for most of them. Some have, right? They're repeat customers. But on the most of it, it's really, you know, how would this work? And so knowing the process, educating, especially as lawyers, because we like that education to be informed consumers, But it makes it also powerful because it's really how to get to the goal of not just selling, not just buying, but successfully selling or successfully buying if you know the process and the steps that you shouldn't skip, right? Those deal killers to kind of go through that or anything else. And then as you mentioned, what we'll talk about today as well is the advisors. Attorneys, I think overall are getting better at seeking, you know, advisory help from others, not trying to do it all on their own. Better, right? But there is a challenge for us because I think even that term of being competent, right? We're like, oh, we can learn how to do this. We can teach ourselves how to do this. But really it's a space, as you kind of mentioned, huge opportunity to grow, huge opportunity to, you know, sell and monetize the value of your firm. But if you don't have the right team helping you, you will make missteps. So I think that's the key part is, you know, making sure you know the process, know who should be on your team, and really how to get to that success at the end. Not just get to the end, I bought something, I sold something, but make sure, you know, truly it's a win-win for both parties.
All right, so let's talk about the process. What does a process look like from the buyer's side?
Yeah, absolutely. So from a buyer side and a seller side, we really break it up into three steps. First step or first phase is your discovery mode. As a buyer, right, in discovery, you're really getting, you know, a strategy together. What is your strategic plan for acquisition? And I'll give kind of an example of this, Sasha. We have, you know, five times as many buyers contact a law practice exchange as sellers. So we have way more buyers contacting us than sellers. Now, part of that's, you know, sellers actually have to age, retire, get motivated to do exit planning or succession planning. But overall, the biggest thing is those buyers really disqualify themselves because, you know, they come in and they say, I want to buy a law firm. Okay. What kind of law firm do you want to buy? I'm open to all practice areas. Okay, well, what kind of practice area do you practice, right? Well, I do estate planning this. Well, you probably don't want to buy, you know, a personal injury, or maybe you do, but, you know, you probably don't want to buy this type. So it's really knowing, right, like what would be that strategic fit. And then even with locations, right, looking at it as a strategic growth. If, you know, they're working with good marketing advisors, right, and they've got a strategic growth and marketing plan, making sure that their acquisition is going to fit their goals for growth, truly. And the hard part, I think, is there's not always an immediate opportunity in the marketplace. There's not always something to buy to fit that need. And so lawyers that are interested in buying sometimes stretch and they say, okay, well, there's no estate planning practice available in my town right now. So I'm going to jump and say, yeah, sure, I'll start doing real estate law. No, it's the wrong move. It's really knowing what is the strategic fit for your goals, right? To grow revenue, but how do you want to grow revenue? Do you want to diversify practice areas, add new markets, you know, stay within the same practice areas, anything else? So in our discovery phase, it's really about determining your strategic acquisition or buy plan. What is that? What does that really look like to you as a buyer? And making sure that, hey, look, just because something's not on the market right now and you can't buy right now, having the plan and really knowing what fits, what's going to fit for your practice and firm is much better to sit and wait for that to come available or go search for that than to jump at something that's not the right strategic fit. The other part of discovery
is... Sorry to interrupt for a second, yeah, but I think this is a really important point. What is, if you have that number, what is an average time from beginning of search to completion of search? Is there a metric like this?
Yeah, you know, informal metric, I would tell you, you know, some hit it right away because there's an opportunity. Mm-hmm. But when you really go into search mode, some lawyers and firms have been searching for, you know, months or years for that right opportunity. Right. I mean, part of our goal, you mentioned building our marketplace that we have at the Law Practice Exchange, is to shorten that, right? Come to the marketplace, like be able to search, you know, keep current on potential opportunities and allow sellers to easily match. So, you know, that time can take that, you know, take longer. But also once you know what you really want, and if we kind of play this forward, if you decide that you're a personal injury attorney and that's what you are, right? This is what you do. You don't need to do estate planning, criminal law, anything else. And you want to grow geographically. right? So you've got your market lockdown and growth and everything else, but you know, two metros over, you know, you don't have that market, or in another state or anything else. So then you really know personal injury, but in this market, you determine your funding, which is kind of part of the discovery phase as well. How much can you afford, right? Just like buying a house, you want to make sure that, like, you've gotten pre-qualified with a funding partner, like a SBA lender, you know, equity group, whoever's going to help you with this, and go, and then you can reach out and start searching, right? There's attorneys based on age, demographic, just to open up conversations to really help expedite that. I mean, the Law Practice Exchange, we do that for buyer clients, is we go on search to help them speed up that process and, you know, navigate a little bit the conversations early on to make sure the parties are meeting in that structure. So it can take a while, but actually having your true fit goals and, you know, that assessment and strategic plan really does help streamline it, especially if you can put some efforts specifically into outreach and contacting.
Great.
And then, you know, as we're talking about that discovery phase for buyers, you have to get the right team ready, right? If you find the opportunity. So one of the biggest challenges that we see between buyers and sellers, you find a good opportunity. You're a buyer and you find that personal injury practice in another town, another city. It's a potential good fit, but then what? You've had a good conversation with seller. Seller's interested, you know, pending how this is all going to work, but how does it move forward? And that's really where having, you know, maybe you have a firm administrator that's a CPA or accountant, but having a good qualified, like, fractional CFO, a good accountant who can really take on, you know, numbers. Of course, we do this too from deal advisory and everything else, but really take on financials, look at the opportunity, help you build out, how would this work? How would this really work if we acquired this? Does what we have as one plus what we would be acquiring as one equal two? Does it equal 1.5 because it's actually going to pull resources away from what we're trying to do? Or can 1 + 1 actually equal 3? Can we take these two, eliminate some costs, streamline some things, and really get things to grow? And so, you know, having a good CPA or accountant on your team, having a good, you know, marketing, you know, advisor as well, because when you integrate two potential brands, there are a lot of marketing questions to go with that, right?
Absolutely.
And we advise, like, if you're a buyer, especially if you're looking at a significant buy, having these individuals on the team early, because they will help with, like, asking the right questions, planning things out. And then the other, as I kind of mentioned, is, of course, you know, having your lender. Most law firm acquisition deals are going to require some form of capital. And you could, of course, have that, but also to have an SBA, you know, pre-commitment, it lets the sellers know you're committed and you're funded. Just like, again, going to buy a house or a condo or anything else, you need that, you know, pre-qualified letter, you know, to have a buyer, a seller take you serious. And that would be the same thing. So know what your goals are, know what your strategic, you know, search is, and then having that right team in place is discovery phase for the buyer.
And I want to add a couple of quick points to everything that you just said. Number one, do not make the mistake of going to your tax preparer for CFO level advice. Could they? They could. Is there a high probability that they'll be wrong? There's a very high probability that they'll be wrong. A guy or gal who does your taxes will not give you good financial advice, probably, because that's not what they do. You need to go to someone who is a CFO certified or chief financial officer type of a person who actually knows how to build a business based on finance. It's fine to have an accountant audit the seller's books. Perfectly fine. They'll find what you will not find because that's what they do. It's not a good idea to go to them for financial advice. You have to do a CFO. And as far as you mentioned SBA loan, it's worth mentioning that SBA, Small Business Administration, provides 7A type loans for acquisition of small business. I believe it's called 7A, and it's up to $3.5 million. So you could get financing for certain types of businesses, including law firms, with as little as 10% down, and they'll finance if it makes sense. And this is where it's great because you will also get some advisory from the lender. If it doesn't make sense, they'll tell you we cannot fund this because the numbers don't make sense. But yeah, you can get good financing.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, Sasha. And SBA's, you know, upped it to, I think they'll lend up to $5 million on those. And
I did not know that.
Yeah. So now they've even increased it. And they've had some, you know, different incentives floating around as well. But, you know, the SBA is still the lender's decision. And I think to your point, it's a great one. And what we've encouraged buyers to do, whether you use lending or not, having a bank review it, right, from an independent and say, we don't like it. Right. Yeah. Well, then that gives you an idea of maybe I don't like it either. Right. Because it's not going to finance. It's not going to cash flow. And SBA terms are pretty favorable based on the repayment term and everything else. So they work pretty well. So if it can't really cash flow under those type of loan terms, then, you know, potentially you're paying too much or you need to restructure that deal or it's not the right deal for you at all. And so they're almost like a free advisor, a free, you know, another opinion to do so, which is, you know, huge when you're just trying to explore, right? So getting paired with a good lender who's going to give you good advice, do that review is key. That's a great point.
Let me hear your advice on this also. Not all SBA lenders are created equal, although the guidelines are the guidelines, but different SBA lenders may view risk differently. Because of that, there are certain searchers that will go to up to three SBA lenders and will have them review deals. Usually there is a nominal fee for review. It could be substantial, but even if you invest $5,000, $10,000 into getting that review, that can save you hundreds of thousands, if not more, down the road. Worth it. Do not save money on due diligence. It will cost you a lot more down the road and quickly. You'll learn it quickly within months of acquisition.
That's absolutely right. And, you know, to your point, you know, so we have our trusted partners, you know, as lenders that lend to law firms or lend on law firm deals. Because, you know, over a decade of doing this, we've had, to your point, you know, other just, you know, banks that do SBA lending and they don't really do SBA lending for law firms, right? Or for law firm transactions. And so the sad part of that is it's not just that, you know, it's more time. It's also typically more cost to, you know, the buyers because they go through just more headaches to get there. So, you know, just like anything else, going for marketing of somebody that understands law firms, going to brokerage that somebody understands law firms, you would want to go to a lender that understands law firms and what you're trying to do based on that acquisition makes it so much more beneficial as their advisory, you know, aspect that can come in, but also just getting the deal done when that time comes, it's going to be far better.
Who would you go to actually value the business?
Us, the Law Practice Exchange. Mm-hmm. So that's a key part of what we do is standalone valuations. We do those for some of our institutional or what we call our elite buyers that really are on an acquisition roll-up strategy. Like their goal is to acquire X number of firms in these markets over the next few years. And so for those, we're doing, you know, valuations, helping them. But for a lot of law firm owners, they come to us just to get a benchmark. Maybe they're interested in selling 5 years, 10 years, 15 years down the road. But, you know, I think for a lot of them, as we do more of this, right, like you're out there talking about building value in your firm through doing good things, they ask the question, well, what is my value right now, right? And so that's the opportunity for us really, you know, again, as we lead the marketplace, part of it is, you know, we've been collecting data deals for 10 years. Right. So it's not just giving advice on, oh, well, here's what the guides say or anything else, but it's really deploying of, you know, we've been leading the marketplace for buying, selling, succession, and being able to really deploy that data for here is where your value is today. If you potentially can do these things, here's what's going to improve the value going forward. Right. So I think in our previous one, you and I may have talked a little bit about, you know, systems and good marketing, firm branding, right? Like those are things like if you're here now and, you know, you're not really immediately want to sell, you're not, you know, in the market for succession, you just want to know if I'm building and am I building right? And I think that's the opportunity to really say, take a benchmark and then improve on it, right? You know what you're building. And especially if you're building on it for exit, which is really cool in my world, because I don't think that was ever talked about 10 years ago when I started. But now I'm really seeing more of those entrepreneurial attorneys who are coming and saying, I'm building this to exit it, you know, in 10 years. And so I just want to make sure we're doing the right thing. But on valuation. Again, if you're a buyer exploring a deal, we do tons of buy-side valuations to look and make sure that works, as well, of course, our sellers for, you know, their sales and succession planning as well.
Such an important point. If you already own a law firm, you should get it valued every 2-3 years. Not with your accountant. Again, not with your accountant. Not the right person. With a professional who understands what a business is actually worth and how to value them. And the reason why I think it's very important, if you own a law firm, it's supposed to be an asset that you will exit from by default because you retire and can sell it, or by design because you actually plan it and know how much you want to offload it for. And when you do it by design, valuing the business periodically gives you that goalpost. Like, are you moving in the right direction? Warren Buffett's of the world, they're valuing their businesses every year to see whether they're creating more shareholder value, standing still, or declining. That's really, as an owner of a law firm, you can be a leader, you can be practicing attorney without your law firm, but that's really the goal. It's not how much money you're making today. It's whether what you're creating is valuable or not, because you can have a job and make plenty of money in the job. You don't necessarily have to own a law firm.
Well, that's right. And, you know, knowing the value of what you have, it's just, you know, knowing how much money you have in the bank, right? Knowing how much value you have tied to your law firm really allows you to plan for, well, when is my exit going to be, right? Like, what's that timeline? What does it look like? You know, because if you know you've got $1 million or a $10 million firm, right, that should matter on how long you have to keep running that firm or building that firm or otherwise to do that. And the other part that, Sasha, is something that we see quite often amongst different partnerships. So we do a lot of solo owned, you know, firms because, you know, they're owned, they're controlled, those owners can make decisions, but we do a lot of succession planning. And as part of that, part of the valuation component for partnerships and larger firms. And the biggest challenge is when they come late in the game and they say, hey, we've got a partner that's getting ready to retire, you know, probably another 1-2 years away. We've got some younger ones, whatever else. And we really just need to know our valuation because we want to build out, you know, a retirement exit model to do this. And the challenge is at that point, probably of, you know, you've got 6 equity partners, you've got maybe at least 4 or 5 different opinions on what value means for the firm.
Smashed expectations.
Right. And so if we come in and give a market value, it may be way higher, right, than somebody thought, you know, usually probably the younger attorney coming in who would be forced with, you know, paying that. They've just never thought of it that way, yep. Right, as kind of building that out. And then it's just really getting that point where we've told, you know, those clients that come to us, look, again, valuation is where it all starts. Getting an agreement on value, if you get past that hurdle of we agree on the concept of what value means for our firm, you can do anything. You can develop a succession plan. You can develop an exit strategy, right? But if you can't get past that, if there's too much disagreement, you know, succession planning isn't possible, right? Because you will just have too much disagreement and you'll probably have a partner who thinks their firm's, you know, their practice is worth $8 million. And you've got one down here that thinks it's only 50,000. That partner that's 8, they may depart, right? They may spin off and do something else because they really feel that, or the younger one will. And that's the challenge you face with not having a concept or an agreement on valuation in a multi-partner firm.
And there is an easy way to prevent this from happening, and that is having a buy-sell agreement that actually spells out, and this could be 10, 15, 20 years looking into the future, how the exit or how valuation is going to be done. And I know a ton about this because my partner and I have just concluded working on our buy-sell agreement. And we've been working together as partners for 6.5 years. We have a number, but now we formalized it.
Yeah.
So I've been buying equity in our company over the years, but now we put it on paper. So one day, if one of us suddenly passes away or we decide to part ways, our attorney has drafted an agreement that says our attorney will be responsible for bringing independent parties who are going to value our business. There will be 2 parties that will value the business. If opinions are greatly apart, they will be, the attorneys, not us, responsible for finding a third party that's going to value the business, and then it's going to be, there's a formula that actually establishes what the value will be. Yeah. If we ever have a disagreement, and we have a client, just talked to them this morning, the partnership is breaking apart. They're bickering. What's the value of the firm?
Right.
Can't agree on it, but one partner has to go. It's a terrible situation, but if you put it in writing years ahead, you do not have to face that situation at all. You know exactly how it will be executed.
And I know we're off topic maybe from buyer discovery phase, but I think this is really important. And your point, Sasha, what we've really encouraged, even when you don't have a partner, maybe you're a solo, a small partnership or anything else, but you know there's, you know, a peer, a good next generation attorney. We really believe in doing buy-sell agreements outside the firm, right? So, you know, you're a solo owner, right? Doing estate planning, anything else. And, you know, the town next door has a solo estate planning attorney that you really respect, think is awesome, right? You're not ready to sell, but under a disaster situation, if something were to happen to you, you can enter into an assumption buy-sell agreement with somebody, right? Next town over, who is your successor? Probably going to end up being your buyer. And the easy way to build that succession plan outside of your firm, if you don't have a potential partner inside your firm, is to just look and say, look, I think you do great things. You know, we're in similar practice areas. I'd love to develop something that if something happens to me or when I'm ready to retire, that I can go to you and say, here. And just like you and your partner did, you can agree on a concept for how that will be valued, how it will be paid, right? To really set up your succession plan, even if you don't have a partner, even if you don't have a natural associate to take over your practice.
Never thought about that. That's a really interesting insight.
Well, we like it because especially in smaller communities otherwise where there may be a lack of associates, right? There may be a lack, but you know, the community over may have that great next generation attorney that's doing a great job, and that could be your potential successor, right? Yeah, so looking at those different things and just, you know, thinking outside the box, being creative, but using those core principles. Hey, if we can agree on valuation and terms now, I mean, it's a great disaster plan, right? To make sure that if disaster strikes, but on a flip side, if my retirement timeline is 10 or 15 years away and we keep a good relationship, then, you know, when I get to that point, it's like, hey, you ready to buy? I'm ready to retire. And it's already built. It's already there from that side. And everybody always asks, well, what if something happens, right? What if you know, that other attorney, you don't like them anymore? Well, you know, attorneys are great contingency planners. And in any good agreement, there could be an exit clause or anything else from that side if you needed to do that. So it's not locking yourself in for 15 years. It's just trying to pre-structure as much as you can.
Yeah. Super. Now I'm thinking, if I was an attorney listening to this, whether I wanted to buy or sell my business, I'm like, especially if I wanted to sell my business one day, well, how much is it worth? What's the valuation model? And does your main practice area or the only practice area play a role when it comes to valuing the business?
Yeah, it really does. Because we do market valuations, right? And I tell everybody, you know, building this marketplace, right? Which we created a software application to help, you know, welcome you into our community, educate you on buying and selling. And then when you're ready to buy or when you're ready to sell, you can direct connect, right? You know, confidentially, everything else, direct connect with buyer potentials, seller potentials. And then, you know, our team's there to help as needed. But really, it's an easy intro to learn, prepare, and when you're ready to actually transact. And, you know, to your point on the valuation market, right now, like personal injury is a very active practice area. There's lots of buyers looking for certain types of firms in personal injury, right? And so if you are sitting there in this space, good firm, good financials, great brand, good marketing, right? Doing all of this, then you will probably get a higher value, right? Than maybe an estate planning firm that works on personal referrals otherwise. In the same metro market, anything else, just because there's more brand and there's more buyers willing to take on risk under a personal injury metric than maybe an estate planning metric.
So, what if all factors were equal? Everything was the same. The only difference, profitability was the same. Revenue was the same. Brand awareness was the same. Marketing, everything. Mm-hmm. But one is PI, another one is estate planning. Would valuation still be different because there is more demand for PI firms?
Yep. There would be, you know, the valuation would probably be higher because, again, there's more of a market acceptance. There's more buyers in the market willing to pay more on better terms for that. I mean, you know, I know, and most of, you know, the listeners know, there's still a lot of differences between an estate planning practice and a PI. One of the reasons that personal injury typically demands a higher valuation is they've spent a lot of time building out the firm marketing, right? Hopefully they have. If not, they should, you know, talk to you and, you know, your team to make sure they do the right things. But overall, it's they've spent that time building out firm marketing. A lot of estate planning firms still operate, some in the digital marketing space, but still operate on personal marketing, network, referrals. And that has a transition risk upon sale, right? That all of our buyers see and everything else. Plus, you're probably selling to another estate planning firm, which haven't, you know, probably advanced their business systems as much as some of our personal injury firms. That's kind of a blank statement. We know there's great estate planning firms out there that far surpass some of the other personal injury, but that's just a comparative analysis is, yeah, there's more buyers, there's more market demand, and you've probably done some stuff because of the practice area that's etched you up into a better business box overall.
What about family law? Where do they fit in?
Yeah, so family law, you know, we transact family law firms all the time. We have, I'm sure, a couple on the marketplace right now. It's traditionally been a good practice area, but it's tough and it's been tough the last few years. So family law is a good example of they can be very profitable. They can have built a good brand, but finding buyers to get excited about buying family law has been a challenge. And the reason is not because you don't have entrepreneurial family law attorneys. The reason more is a lot of them have been very busy for the last several years. So it hasn't been really looking for more work. It's getting the work done and hiring good attorneys to help them get the work done has been a common focus. And actually some of the deal killers we've had are like, I'd buy that firm if it came with five attorneys, but I don't want to buy this, you know, $1 million revenue firm if it doesn't come with any attorneys, right? Well, the only attorney wants to retire and exit. I don't need that revenue. I need attorneys to really process some of that. And I think that's slowing down a little bit for family law attorneys and it will change back to normalcy. But since they've been so busy and they've been in need of good quality attorneys as part of their team, they haven't been aggressively pursuing growth because it's come through natural marketing. And even if they grew overnight, that growth has to be supported by more attorneys. And they've just had a challenge really, you know, keeping that funded and fueled.
I'm going to make an admission that if today I was on the market for a law firm, I would be looking for a family law. Absolutely. The reason for that is it's virtually impossible to replace family law with AI. There's always demand. Average case value is high enough to justify substantial marketing. And because most family law attorneys have no idea how to market effectively, you can enter with an existing brand and start dominating the market within 3 to 5 years.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you at all.
Great practice area.
Yeah, and I think, you know, from that standpoint, it's, you know, it becomes a recruiting good talent, right? Making good systems and process so that you're not leaving a talent or those attorneys on an island, right? It's really building out systems that can support them more than some, you know, other firms. But yeah, I don't disagree with you. I mean, so much focus, Sasha, to your point, is on personal injury. I mean, even us, we talk about it a lot, but there is great practice areas and significant movement in others. You know, immigration is another one, intellectual property, because it has, like, there's a lot of movement and kind of other things that comes into play. But family law, if you're looking to roll up, and I've always said that they're kind of following the path of personal injury, but not as much, right? But the case values are high, like you said, significant high case values. Demand is great. Yep. Consumer choice, like, you try to say, you need me now. And they say, yes, I need you now. And they're going to engage quickly compared to some other practices of law that have slow consumer decision. Yeah, I mean, I think it would be tremendous. And of course, we do have firms out there as well, you know, looking to grow and roll up to be more regional, national family law firms, you know, based on what you said. I mean, they see the value in it and they just need to, you know, bring the right team and the right people. And a lot of good family law attorneys out there, they just need to find the right home.
What's the valuation model for most relatively small law firms?
Yeah, most of it is based on a multiple of earnings, right? So when we talk about earnings, we're talking really about your, you know, your net cash flow after all expenses, everything else is paid, right? So to some attorneys, you know, it's, you know, adjusted net income or EBITDA, earnings before income taxes, depreciation, amortization, right? But, you know, at a base level, if you're running an everyday small law firm, it's really, you know, you bring this much in client payments, right? Your revenues, you have these expenses to pay, like your paralegals, your office expense, right? Marketing, everything else. And then you should be paying yourself a fair salary for the legal work and the work that you're doing that produces revenue. So that's a key point, because we run into a lot of times where attorneys say, oh, you know, I have a $700,000 revenue firm and I make $400,000+ a year. And we're like, well, that's a tremendous profit margin. And when we get into it, they don't pay themselves any salary.
Right.
But if they had to pay themselves a salary or they had to replace themselves, it would cost $200,000. So really you have a $700,000 gross revenue firm, subtract out that $200,000 replacement salary you should have been paying, and you're making $200,000. Still a good margin, not bad. But it's just, you know, a little bit different, because that's the net earnings, or what we call the true owner benefit. I mean, If you own a business, and a law firm is a business, you want benefit from ownership, right? You want that business to pay you profits, right? Dividends, distributions, whatever you want to call it. But you want to make profit from that business without just your efforts. Your efforts can be part of it, but at the end of each month, quarter, year, whatever, you want some cash coming to you. That's why you own a business, right?
Are you saying the name on the door is not enough?
The name on the door is great. It's good, right? It's good. Probably could be rebranded, right? But the name on the door is great. And for a lot, I know law was a calling, but you have probably developed a business. And when you look at it and get to it, that's what a buyer is going to pay for. They're going to pay for what you're able to receive on a monthly, quarterly, annual basis from this business that can be transferred to them. And not every dollar might be transferable. There might be some adjustments you have to make and everything else. But, you know, under that firm example we were giving, if $200,000 a year is what you truly are taking home from this business after everybody, including yourself or a replacement for you, has been paid, that's a nice little return. Right. And if we're looking to value that, typically in the marketplace, it's going to be somewhere on a very low end, probably around a 2x that. So you're talking about 400,000. On a higher end, it's going to be, you know, 3 to 3.5, 4, depending on the practice area. And of course, we have larger firms that just want to break through that because their profit margin and earnings are much more significant. But for your everyday firm, you're going to be between 2 and 3. Right. So you get to say, okay, my true owner's benefit is $200,000 a year. It's worth between $400,000 and $600,000. That can make you excited. That can make you less excited, you know, for that or anything else. But if you're looking at your exit retirement and you know that, wait a minute, I could get, you know, $600,000 for my firm, that can either move your timeline up, right? It can move your timeline back. But overall, that's a value concept that to me has been overlooked in our profession for years and can really help attorneys move when it comes to developing succession to preserve that value, transfer it to somebody else, right? Take care of clients, the employees, everything else.
Where do you need to be with EBITDA, earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, amortization, like pure profit? Where do you need to be with, by the way, for those of you who may be like, why do you need to subtract out interest? Because when you sell a business, you have to pay off the debt that the business has. So you're buying a business without debt, or that's the way it's supposed to be, unless you're acquiring right. The debt, but then it has to be factored in. So where do you need to be with EBITDA to make it more exciting, to go from that 2 to 3x EBITDA to maybe 4, 5, 6, 7?
40%, 50% of your revenues, right?
And has I mean, to be profit.
Yeah, I mean, if we're talking about, you know, that as far as an EBITDA multiple, you know, really the groups out there looking right now to pay like a 4 or 5 are looking for at least 10 million in EBITDA. So that means
you have a big business.
You own a big business, right? Yeah. And so for most of those are our personal injury attorneys, right? Mm-hmm. Sure. They built big businesses. You know, again, we have estate planning firms doing that. I'm not saying that at all, but for the typical in the market, that's going to be your personal injury or your plaintiff firms. You know, less than that, will it work on a high profit margin? Absolutely. Less than that with really significant growth trends and plans? Yeah. Right. And less than that, but super efficient. You've built systems, right? You're doing everything. And it's really can be shown as this business is not a transition or a transfer risk. It's like I could go away for 3 weeks or 3 months and the business would keep going. Then, yeah, you're going to get a higher multiple and better payment terms on that. Mm-hmm. And the coolest part, Sasha, and I know you know this too, in you know, helping firms is, you know, seeing the uniqueness of what some firms are building. And for our side, like watching the market react to that, because, you know, several years ago, they'd be like, ah, it's a law firm. But now they're like, oh, this attorney has built something that is a law firm, delivers great client service, but behind the scenes, I mean, it really looks more like a tech firm, right? Yeah. Like they built so much supporting systems and everything else to that and everything, you know, so it's really neat to see that and watch the market react, which is the good part of moving value up, right?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, we see all sorts.
It's such a good point for somebody who may be tech inclined, but is deferring investment into your technology. You may have a buyer that will look at your business and it may be doing that $200,000, $400,000, $500,000 in EBITDA, but they will not value it at 3 times that EBITDA. They will value it at 5 or 6 because they're not buying that. They're buying your technology stack, the way that you built it. And all of a sudden, like if they buy your processes, their operations become a lot more efficient.
Yeah. I mean, it's really cool because, of course, you see other businesses that have done this. But, you know, we've got firms that have, you know, 3 to 4, 5 engineers on their staff permanently, right? For just
software engineers.
Mm-hmm. They have software, they have IEs, right? Which industrial engineers just looking at process flow.
Oh, that's bigger.
Yeah. I mean, really, you know, and the goal is, do we have a system to make us more efficient? If we don't, we need to develop one. And then can we automate or build that or, you know, update or integrate something to make us better, right? Make us more efficient, deliver better client service, better value from that. And I mean, that seems so foreign maybe for your everyday law firm. But I think with certain things moving like AI and otherwise, there's going to be components that you'll be able to interlock and deliver more value, do it more efficiently, right? To kind of carry that forward. So it'll be interesting.
Fascinating. So you set your goals, you hire your deal team if you're on the buyer side, or you hire your sell team if you're on the selling side. Now you're in the process. What are the common deal killers? Like what happens in the process where it just falls apart?
Yeah, our first one really is, you know, one, if you've skipped that, like knowing your goals. So if you're a buyer, right, knowing your goals. If you're a seller also, it's what is really your strategic buy fit, knowing what who that ideal buyer is and what are your goals to selling. Because sellers, the real deal killer that we see with any deal, probably the number one, is seller emotions. And it's not a bad thing. Like I'm not saying like sellers are blowing up and yelling at everybody. It's really an emotional block. For a lot of our sellers, they've been an attorney, a lawyer for 30 years, 35, 40 years, 50 years, right? And when they get to the point of selling, all sorts of emotional, you know, they don't even realize it, roadblocks. They say all the right things. I want to sell anything else. But fear kind of, you know, weaves itself into that. And that's really something to just know as a potential buyer. And of course, as a potential seller, different things like, oh, I don't think this is the right buyer, or I need more money than this. Those are probably not true. You're just, you know, you're focusing on, this is beyond my comfort level. Like, I'm going to be replaced. I'm going to no longer control my firm, right? And so the biggest thing is what we have traditionally done is work with our sellers on, you need to paint the picture of what really you need, what kind of deal you would accept, right? And when it comes to the ideal buyer, sure, you know, have that down, but also be open to all sorts of others. Because as the next generation of firms change, so do your buyers, right? So you've been a solo owner, practicing attorney here, and this other firm comes in very interested in doing this, great reputation, wants to do that. But their goal is they're going to actually deploy, you know, fractional attorneys that rotate in and out of market, you know, with this. And you're like, nah, it just won't work. Well, before you do that, because there's a fear over, I've been doing it this way, and now somebody's trying to change that. Before you do that, really look at the, you know, what is the problem? And a lot of times the problem is an emotional roadblock. And as I shared earlier, we see 5 times as many buyers as sellers that are coming to the market right now. A lot of that's just because of seller emotional roadblock. There is a fear over retirement for lawyers. If I'm a lawyer and I retire, what do I call myself?
Who am I without this thing?
Who am I? If I no longer have my law firm, what do I do? I've been at this 6 days a week, 7 days a week for 40, 50 years. What do I do? Right. And of course they're like, oh, spouse wants to travel. I want to spend time with grandkids, all this other aspect. But it is, I would say that's our number one deal killer is seller emotions. And that's not a fault to the sellers. I think it's the most is recognize it early. And if you're a buyer, know it's there. Right. So a big thing to closing deals is not the financials. Those usually aren't our deal killers. Mm. It's really the transition plan.
How are
things going to happen once seller, you know, turns over the reins to buyer? And if you're a buyer and you can really spell out a good, solid transition plan, and you know, as an example, if you've been running a firm, Sasha, and you've, you know, been in your community for 40 years, I'm coming in to be a buyer, you know, my response could be like, oh, I've got all this technology, I've got a marketing plan, I'm going to roll, we're going to change. Or I could be like, Sasha, you built a great firm. My first goal is not to change anything, right? I don't want to disrupt what you've built. Over time, we will integrate and do that. But my goal is to preserve what you've built. And for you, Sasha, if you want to stay on as the owner, if you want to stay on afterwards in a transition, you tell me what your timeline is. I'd love to have you as a practicing attorney, right?
Sure.
I want to make sure to retain all of your people, right? Go through that and really develop and say, you know, when it comes to integrating your referral sources, we'll work together, right? Buyer, seller, working together to go through and take them to coffee, take them to lunch, right? Go through this. We'll put forth that effort. And your firm name and marketing, you've done a great job. You've hired a great marketing company. You've got this. We're going to keep that as is for now and just file a DBA. And then we'll slowly integrate it over time, mm-hmm. right? We'll merge it over time. But we don't want to disrupt. To a seller who has that emotional roadblock, they just heard not a lot's going to change. Everybody's going to be taken care of, including them, right? And there is a solid, well-thought-out plan to really transitioning with preservation as the goal. Not change is the goal, preservation. And I think, you know, to most of our sellers, that would mean a lot, more so than how much down am I getting versus how much is going to be paid over time, right? And that sounds weird. Some of our sellers, of course, want to know how much down versus that. But most, it's about, you know, that buyer fit and what the transition plan would look like.
That's fascinating and makes so much sense. And I assume that buyers have to come in to this thing with integrity. And when they say, I'm not planning to change anything, that has to be your plan. Because if you're planning to create a revolution within the business, tell them. Chances are they're going to retain some sort of ownership. There will be an earn out or other type of agreement, which will cause a lot of tension if you're not forthcoming about your plan.
Absolutely. And to that point, Sasha, if you see a firm that needs an overhaul, and that is your plan, right, to be open and honest, and if that doesn't work for the seller or anything else, then that's not the deal for you. And that's not the deal for the seller, right?
Look,
they're not going to see it. And they're going to, even if you complete and force that deal through, the seller is not going to work well with you post, you know, closing, post sale.
Will be
and
a nightmare.
You don't want that. No.
Will be an absolute nightmare. All right. So that's the number one. Give us a second, very, very common deal killer.
Yeah, I think the next one really is, do you have time to devote to the process? And I'll say this to sellers and buyers both, right? Especially lawyers. And again, you know, similar clients, we know, you know, you're running the practice, you know, practicing law, everything else, they're busy. But when we have a seller who gets into, you know, the marketplace and then they have a buyer that says, oh, I'm really interested, I'd love to set up a call. And they say, I'm really busy the next month. I can set up a call, you know, in the next 30 days. You're going to lose that buyer, right? And when the buyer asks you for some financial information and you're slow to respond because you're just, you know, you have to commit the time. And if you're a buyer, it's the same thing, you know, working with your advisors, we talked about that prep, but if you're a buyer and you explore something, you're going to have to commit the time to explore it. And you're going to have to commit the time to review the financials with your fractional CFO. You're going to have to commit the time to structure the deal, right? With, you know, us or somebody else to really help do that. And then you're going to have to commit the time to go through due diligence and close it and develop that transition. And so the best ones that we really see are sellers that have built themselves at least into a role where they have delegated some work and they are in a firm ownership management role, at least fractionally, right? They may still do some legal work, but they're not doing it all. Right? They may do, you know, some significant firm management, but they're not doing it all. And the same thing with buyers. The buyers that have moved themselves because of systems, because of investment in that, which you and I just talked about, they move them that they don't have a 2-week trial that they can't, you know, focus on anything else for the next few months. That's when you have the time, great things can happen, right? When you don't have the time, those deals die. And they just die because, you know, parties get uninterested or they feel like there's deal fatigue when really there wasn't any movement. It just took, you know, time that nobody wanted to devote to that process, right? And then, you know, my next probably biggest deal killer would be the financials. Knowing truly what, if you're a buyer, if you're looking at buying a firm, if you don't know what the value of that firm is, then you need it. And so, you know, getting a valuation through us or working with a CFO to really do a deep dive on financials. And the same thing with the seller. A lot of sellers, again, will, you know, go forward and they'll say, yeah, I've never had a valuation done, but I'm interested in selling. And the buyer will say, well, this is what we're considering offering. And the seller will say, nah, I think it's worth, you know, 3 times that. But they have no clue, right? And we've actually been kind of the next option a lot of times after a seller has killed the deal, because they've asked for 3 times that when it was really, you know, 1 times that what was offered. But they come to us and say, yeah, I had somebody offer me this, but I thought it was a ridiculously low offer. And we say, no, that was a good offer. And they're, you know, they've made that misstep, right? They've killed that deal when they really, you know, just need an opinion of what is it that it's worth and how would this deal really work?
I think it's true. And I've been on both sides of the transaction that most sellers overvalue their business and most buyers undervalue the business that they're buying.
Sure.
There's one, and you and I can talk about this for hours and possibly days and weeks, but I respect your time. So I just want to add one touch point, and that is if you're looking to buy a business, if you're looking to buy a law firm, I think you have to set aside a lot of time for integrating yourself into that business. If you have a substantial team, you may not have to invest a lot of your time, but having bought a business, I can tell you that first year, as a buyer of an existing business, and the people who built that business up to the point when I bought it, they didn't leave, they were still there. I've spent majority of my time, year one, on integrating myself into that business. Again, majority of my time for a year, integrating to myself that business. I'm proud to say that this year, our, not revenue, but our profit, this is my 7th year in the business, will be 1,000%, 10 times greater than it was 7 years ago. It's not an overnight thing. Right. Seven years, you know, and first year, again, mostly time on integrating myself into the systems and understanding what can be better.
And that's the key part. I know, Sasha, you opened with the opportunity for acquisition, right? The growth potential, like, you know, you've 7 times, you know, your profit, or no, excuse me, 10 times your profit over the last 7 years. But it's where you started from, right? You're not starting from zero.
Yeah. And it's, I think that's to start from zero.
You know, so many attorneys would look, if they start a firm from truly zero, they're not paying themselves and they don't have money to pay others.
Yeah.
If you acquire a firm, you're paying yourself and you have money to pay others. Then, to your point, your time is not focused on, like, you know, growing from ground roots, running to every coffee meeting, doing everything you could, right? It's really focused on what is going to make this integration work well, right? And I think you're very smart. What you did was that full focus of, you know, this first year is all about making this transition work. After that, it just becomes easier. But if we miss those steps right out of the gate, then we will stumble, right? And we will not see that growth going forward. So that's a hard part, because there's so much, like, legal and financial and other items that kind of come up as we near a closing for a firm. But we really tell everybody the final piece of due diligence is developing that transition plan. How are you going to integrate after purchase? What is the previous owner's role? What is, you know, the new owner's role, and how is that going to work going forward? And you should have that plan, at least a good solid framework for it, prior to close. Because what we found is, if you have that plan and both parties kind of buy into it prior to close, then the day of closing becomes a lot more exciting. And the day after closing, when you start that integration and the seller is starting to step back or into a different role or anything else, it's just easier. The communications are more fluid. Everybody's focused on the same goal. Hey, we need to set up these 10 meetings because these are our biggest referral sources. Let's get our calendars together, right? And do that. Hey, we need to meet with our marketing team because we're going to talk to them about integration, right? That's part of our transition and integration plan. So yeah, I think what you've done is exactly what we would tell buyers to do and our sellers to do. Focus, communicate, and focus on that transition early, and don't forget about it.
Yeah. And if you're sitting on the fence with this idea of one day buying a law firm, I can tell you definitively, I've built businesses from scratch and I bought an existing business. It is infinitely easier to buy an existing business with all the problems that it has than to start a business from scratch and create all the problems from scratch. So buy a business. It's more profitable. It's a faster way to ROI, substantial ROI, but buy it well. And if you own a business, a law firm, and you're thinking about selling it one day, plan that retirement exit well. Don't leave it up to a chance. And Tom, your wealth of information on the subject, how do people connect with you?
Yeah, absolutely. The lawpracticeexchange.com. So the lawpracticeexchange.com is where our marketplace is hosted. Of course, you can find me and my team there. You can find us on, you know, LinkedIn, Tom Linfesti on LinkedIn. That name's a little tricky, so probably the easiest is the lawpracticeexchange.com. But again, we're here as a resource, and Sasha, I'm delighted and, you know, for the opportunity to speak with you twice on this, and hopefully we can continue the conversation, because that has really been our passion in, you know, developing and growing this marketplace. Is if we can share education and really, you know, I know we didn't get into all of the process steps, but I think as we really walk through a lot of these stories and examples, knowing what's possible, but also knowing the opportunities that's out there, is huge. And so for lawyers to really think about it, it will 100%. Help the profession overall. Absolutely.
100%. Tom, thank you so much.
Thanks, Sasha.
Thanks for listening to the Grow Law Firm podcast. If you liked the ideas shared in this episode, help a fellow lawyer out by sharing a link to the episode. This episode is powered by the team of experts in client attraction, growlawfirm.com. Do you want a complimentary growth plan for your law firm? Request it at growlawfirm.com/blueprint.